Accession number 11105, Colonel M. Bain, Reel 15.
Colonel M. McBain, Reel 15. How long were you in hospital?
I suspect I was there for 2 weeks. Because, as I think I said before, by the time I got there, I was really feeling a lot better than I had been. I would say 2 weeks, may have been three. And then, again to my surprise, I was sent on convalescent leave to a little island in the inland sea called Miyajima, off Hiroshima. And I can't remember the journey there at all. I mean, obviously I went there, but I can't remember how. Miyajima was a religious site for Shinto, and we were told that it was where some of the Japanese kamikaze pilots went to pay their respects to their ancestors before they actually went and did it. In mind, it was January time. I went, and the convalescent home was the remains of what had been a very large, expensive hotel pre-war, taken over as a leave centre by the Australian occupation forces in 1945, and they had succeeded in burning it to the ground. And so what was left was a main building, but quite a small single-storey main building, with little bungalows round about in the grounds. And these little bungalows were sort of Madame Butterfly type places. If you visualize, I mean, if you try to visualize a little Japanese place with Madame Butterfly inside, then this would be what these places were, with sliding doors and polished floors. They actually had European style furniture in, I think. Yes, they did, yes. There was only one eye, and we led the life of Riley. We had one of these little bungalows each, and we were woken up in the morning by a little canoe-clad lady bringing our breakfast. And then we'd get up. The weather was kind. It was cold, but I can't remember rain or anything. It was dry, frosty weather. And we just go for a walk. You could walk around the island in a couple of hours. And there were shrines and balls, and the impressive entrance to the island as you came in on the ferry from Hiroshima was Torii arches, which you would have seen photographs of, the sort of H-shaped arches sitting in the sea, great big one with its two legs in the sea. On the island there was a big temple, and for some reason there was a big white horse in this temple. That was part of the setup as well. That obviously had some great significance. But one of the great things was, from the little ferry landing, there was a little village, obviously, where the ferry came in, around the temples. And it was a great, obviously, still was a great tourist place. This little village was geared to tourism, but this was January, and there weren't too many around, except us. And the little street, earth street, I mean, no tarmac or anything, it was sandy street. On both sides were little wooden shops, with open-fronted shops, the veranda, And then the people's house behind, underneath the veranda. And every shop seemed to be gifty shops for the tourists. And for the first couple of days, whenever, and I can't remember his name, I'm afraid, the Australian officer, he was a captain I know in their armoured corps, but I can't remember his name. We got on very well together. We'd walk down the street, and as soon as we appeared at the top end, all the shopkeepers would rush out, and they would start up all these mechanical toys, thinking perhaps we might buy ducks quacking and bears beating drums and dogs barking, pandemonium. But eventually they realised that we weren't in that sort of market, so they didn't bother. But what did happen, quite often, we would be invited in to sit with the family, because they weren't doing anything, because there was nobody to sell anything to. And they would be sitting round, sometimes in British houses, their earthenware pots that come up to about waist height. Quite often in this country now, you see them upside down with umbrellas or walking sticks in them. In fact, if they're up the right way, they've got holes in the top. They are, in fact, charcoal burners. And the family would be sitting around one of these with a blanket over their knees, and we'd sit there and carry on a great conversation. I mean, they couldn't understand a word of English. We couldn't understand a word of Japanese. It didn't seem to matter. Everyone was bowing and hissing and chatting away. That was nice. Well,
the little experience you had of the Japanese at that time, did any of them show any lasting animosity from the war, which was, what, 6 or 7 years gone?
No. And, of course, neither of us had been involved with the war. And we just found, you see, I don't know that the war would have affected the people on this little island. They just wouldn't have been affected, I don't suppose. And certainly, no, there was no animosity. I mean, they'd had the Australians there immediately after the war using the place as a leave centre, so they were quite used to Europeans. Whether you call an Australian a European, I'm not too sure. Caucasian, I suppose. Anyway, we got on very well, there was a Japanese woman running this convalescent centre, and she was normally dressed in a kimono or that sort of thing. And there was a tennis court, and one day, I have to call him something, let's call him Fred. Fred and I asked this woman, is there any tennis kit that we could perhaps just go and hit a ball around? And she said, I will, and said, what do you mean? You play with one of us against him. No, I will play you two. And, of course, it turned out she'd played for Davis Cup before the war, and she appeared in a tracksuit, and she lolloped us all over the court. But that was, I mean, she was giggling the whole time, and we were in fits of laughter, so that was good. What else about the little island? Oh, the range site, there were, I suppose there were mandarin trees. All the leaves had gone, but the mandarins were still on. And so they looked a bit like Christmas decorations on these little trees in gardens and around the little village. And the woman suggested we went up the little hill in the middle of the island where there was a tea house, where someone showed us the traditional Japanese tea ceremony, which was a very complicated, involved business, which I mean, it's a ritual, and you ended up with a pretty foul-tasting little cup of tea at the end of it, but it was part of Japanese life. I must have been there for a fortnight, because halfway through, I had to go back to Kure, to the hospital, for a checkup. And so I got tickets, I suppose, and it was explained to me in great detail how to get on the ferry and go across. which makes me, doesn't make me worry any of this at the beginning, but I can remember quite clearly getting on this little ferry, and I was told when you get off the ferry in Hiroshima, you go down that street and turn right, the tram that goes to Kure. Well, I got ashore at Hiroshima, and there wasn't a lot of visible sign of the atom bomb. Maybe I wasn't near Ground Zero, but most of the buildings were substantial stone buildings from memory. But of course, the great damage was done there because it was a wooden city, fell down when the bomb went off. And I, when I left the island, I went to look at the actual Ground Zero place, but I'm afraid it didn't really have any great... Having been in Berlin and seen Berlin flattened by ordinary bombs, this was another city that had been flattened by another bomb, so it didn't really have a great impact. Anyway, I got ashore at Hiroshima from the little ferry, and it was quite strange. It was the first time, and I think, almost the last time, and I felt completely helpless, lost, because the Japanese don't call Kure Kure. Can't remember what they do. And of course, there's no English at all. The signs are all in Japanese. And there I was in the middle of quite a big city, completely and utterly lost, and I couldn't say anything to anyone. I was in uniform, so I was recognizable. And I was saved, in fact, by half a dozen very small school children in school uniform who came rushing up, and they were obviously learning English at school. And they were all saying, good morning, good morning, good morning, how are you? I thought, that's marvelous. And so I said, where is the tram? And so they took me by the hand, one on each side, and off we went. And they took me to the tram, there it was. And it was one of these sort of continental-type trams, almost a train, like the Newcastle Metro, that ran alongside the main road to Kure. So I got on that. I made one big mistake on the way. It stopped in the middle of nowhere, and a very elderly with a great big fish creel on her back, with a strap across her forehead, and this great big fish creel full of fish. And I stood up and offered her my seat. And God, that really was terrible for everyone. I mean, everyone on the tram was so embarrassed that a man should stand up and offer a seat to a woman, particularly a fisherwoman. So eventually I had to sit down again, because nobody was, the tram had stopped and nobody was going to do anything. And then, you see, I can't remember, I went to the hospital and was checked over, and I can't remember the return journey. But it obviously was just a reverse. But that did mean, in fact, that little journey, I don't know, half an hour or an hour, maybe an hour, I was in closer contact with Japan and the Japanese than most other people who were out there, because, like a lot of other places where the army goes, it sets up its own little cantonment and sticks there and really doesn't get out and about too much. So that was interesting. And then I eventually left there, went back to Kure, and I must have spent a couple of days, I suppose, waiting to go back to the battalion in Kure.
No problem going back to the battalion?
No.
No possibility because you've been out, been sent to some other unit?
No. There wasn't. But again, at that age and that stage of the proceedings, you just assume that you would go back to where you came from. And I think the war, it was such a small, it wasn't like the Second World War with vast numbers of units and so on. So as a regular officer, it would have been most unusual to go anywhere else. The only possibility, I suppose, posted and held at the reinforcement depot or the battle school. There's a battle school in Japan. But no, I spent, I don't know where, whether it was in the reinforcement depot or whether it was just in and around the hospital house, I can't remember. But eventually went by sea from Curie to Pusan.
What date would this be returning to?
Or January, February time. 1953. And then on the great train that chugged its way up from Pusan up to the railhead at Weijongbu. and that, again, you know, as a youngster, it didn't matter. But it was a pretty comic journey. It was an American-run train. And there was all sorts of argument from memory about who was supposed to be feeding, who had the food, and where the food was. And I, like so many other things, I suppose, in any theatre of war, there was a fair amount of racketeering going on. And I suspect that the Americans who were supposed to be feeding us, but who said, no, we've got no food for you, the food had gone somewhere else. We did get food, but I think there was a Canadian major travelling on the train. He really got quite excited with the American NCO who was supposed to be feeding us. Anyway, we eventually got, and I got back to the battalion.
Then anything happened to the battalion whilst you were there?
Well, no, they'd been out of the line for a while over Christmas time, and were about to go back into the line. And when I got back, I was told that I was going to take over the anti-tank platoon. And that was quite exciting, because I'd been in B Company, doing the rifle platoon, and there'd been a shuffle around of various people for various reasons. And Colin Bauer, who had been the anti-tank platoon commander, he was taking over the machine gun platoon, and so on and so forth. And so I was given the anti-tank platoon. And that was very good news, because the anti-tank platoon, there were no tanks involved in the battle, really, and so there was nothing really for the anti-tank platoon to do. And so they had turned it into, and the other, I think all the battalions had done the same, into quite a big organisation with 60 or 70 soldiers. And we had Browning machine guns, 30 calibre Browning machine guns, 10 or 12 of those, and 10 or 12 Bren guns. And we were used to occupy positions that were too big for an ordinary rifle platoon and too small for a company. And they were normally sort of link positions between either between company positions or between battalion positions. And the first one I went on to with my heroes was a little spur running off a very big hill, 0.355, which the battalion was on once or twice. And this was a spur that ran off that hill down into a valley where there had been a road, which was the boundary between ourselves and the next door battalion to the west. And so, as I say, this was good news. And we went on to this position and got it sorted out.
How did you organise the unit?
Well, it was organised, in fact, into sections. And what was, it was into sections with corporals and lance corporals running the sections. And the Browning machine guns scattered around in proper positions. And, you know, it was a fairly tough little organisation. And I was very much my own boss. My company commander, support company commander, was in fact way back running A echelon, you see. He was commanding A echelon, which is the first sort of support echelon behind the battalion. And old Alan, not Alan Turner. Boy, oh boy. Frank. The company commander. Nice man, good man. We got on very well together.
His surname was Taylor.
Taylor. But he was back at A echelon. And so, as I say, I was very much my own boss with my platoon sergeant, Sergeant Smith, Smudger. I mean, he became, I think, probably one of my very best friends in the regiment. He was a great guy. He was a little Yorkshireman with a pug nose who had spent most of the war driving mules around with the Chindits in Burma. So he'd been at it before. And he was a great guy. And we established a relationship that went on way beyond career and so on. There we were. And the first time we went on to this position, yeah, that's right, the whole division had been out of the line. For the first time, the only time, the whole Commonwealth Division had been out. And the American 2nd Division had come in to take over. And they had this very strange system. They were only in the line for a couple of days and then out. So they were constantly on the move. And their idea of defending a place was to stand shoulder and shoulder for 48 hours and then push off back. It was a very strange setup, but anyway. They had actually lost this little hill that I was going on to 3 times. They had started off with a platoon on it, and they'd lost it, so they had to send a company to take it back again. The company had lost it, so they sent a battalion back to take it back again, and a company of tanks. And by the time we got there, I mean, I went up on a recce with Sergeant Smith. We couldn't believe our eyes. I mean, you couldn't move on this hill for soldiers. And they were all in a terrible state. The place was filthy. And the only people you get any sense out of were black Americans. But part of the organization, and I think they had a company on, but it was a big company, 3 big platoons. But they'd only been there a couple of days, this particular lot. But one of the platoons was full of Puerto Ricans, and they spoke Spanish. The officers only spoke English, and so how the hell they communicated with one another, I don't know. They were Puerto Ricans, presumably from New York. And it was all very strange.
Were they, when you say that they, you know, there were difficulties with them, was it due to the fact that they were panicky or that they...
Well, the soldiers clearly hadn't the faintest idea what they were doing or what they were supposed to be doing or whether they were coming or going. And they were just there, standing, as I say, virtually shoulder to shoulder in the trenches. Waiting for something to happen. And we spent a night there because this particular position, you could only get to it in the dark. You had to drive down this road in the dark, and that because the road was in full view of the Chinese when in daylight. We'd gone down in the evening, and so we spent that night there. In fact, we must have spent 2 nights, or we came out on the second night. Because immediately in front of this position, I suppose about 600 yards across a valley, was a hill 227.227, which in fact is the KSLI got a battle honour there, and it is now on the light infantry colours as a battle honour, 0.227. And that's metres, so it's quite a high hill. It was quite steep. It was conical shape from memory. So that was just across there.
Yeah, well, the Chinese on that.
Chinese were on that one. And whether almost certainly the Chinese that had taken this particular position hadn't come from there, we didn't think, but the Americans thought they had. And so at night, the Americans had a searchlight shining on 227. It sounds hysterical now, but this for till now, for years and years. Sergeant Smith and I were there, and we were standing somewhere on this position, talking between ourselves. And suddenly, an American soldier rushed past us and said, "Shit, they're coming. There are thousands of little lights coming down the hill." And we looked. We couldn't see anything. And the cry was taken up. And they started firing and calling for all sorts of... They had a company of tanks with them on this hill. The tanks started firing, pandemonium! And we just... we kept out of the way because we didn't want to get involved with this lot. We just couldn't understand what was happening. After about half an hour, it all fizzled away. Again, without any visible words of command or anything, it all just sort of fizzled away. We then realised what happened. The searchlight was shining on 0.227. It was quite a dark night. And the searchlight's got a beam. I don't know where the actual lamp was. It was obviously behind somewhere. And between the beam shining on the top of 0.227, underneath the beam was black sky with stars. Sort of tropical-sized, big, whopping, great, twinkly stars. And those were the thousands of little lights. And they had thought, or this soldier, this sentry, whoever he was, had thought that these were the Japanese. Whether he thought they were running down the hill with torches in their hands, I don't know. Anyway, so we then... during the day, Sergeant Smith and I were going to put some semblance of order into this place, and we were talking about our standing patrols, which of course we relied on heavily, particularly in this sort of place. And we were standing in the front trench, working out, and the main officer was. And when we explained, we were looking for places to put our standing patrols. He said, "Where are you going to put them?" We said, down on the valley floor, down probably one there, and one there, and so on. And he just couldn't believe it. Couldn't believe it. And I said, "To know if anything's going on." They didn't have anyone forward of the front trench. And so that's why they lost it three times.
Was this usual for the Americans?
Yeah, well, this was the impression one got. This was their normal defensive practice.
So they weren't aggressive patrollers as the...
No. And this is why, of course, the Commonwealth Division, as such, never had any major dramas. I know, obviously, the Black Watch and the battalion had a couple of do's, but nothing on the skins did. They put great... we didn't realise it at the time. So we left, we came out, and went back, sucking our teeth a bit and wondering. Anyway, came the night for the great relief in the line.